Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Rebecca Abraham, Michael Golden, Jennifer Nevins, and Chris Roebling. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8029. That's 1-800-723-8029. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. Want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web at beyondthebeltway.com. That is the audio and video portion of the program, either live or if you forget it, it's there all the time, beyondthebeltway.com. Every week the President of the United States gives us so much to talk about, and we're going to spend 2 hours talking about it. But I want to do something a little bit different than this. All the things that you think we're going to talk about this evening, we are going to talk about. Trade, we're going to talk about guns, a variety of things. We won't spend too much time on Hope Hicks, though. I think that's overstated. But one question that I'm going to start this evening, a little bit different, that isn't directly in the news, but it's sort of indirectly in the news, and that is the integrity of the 2018 voting. There's belief by many, including those in our government, that the Russians, because of what they did in 2016 and prior to that, they're not stopping. They're going to continue to try to disrupt the democratic process and perhaps even voting, the voting machinery of this country. Even though there's no evidence that they did it in 2016, there is evidence that they tried to do it in 2016. So my question to everybody, and we'll spend a segment on this, I'd like to get your reaction. I suggested several months ago on this program that maybe it's time to go back to paper ballots. That paper ballots, at least in my view, there is a paper trail. Maybe the American people would be more comfortable with an old-fashioned paper ballot than with all the new-fangled things that many of us have gotten used to. Michael Golden, I'm going to start with you. You've written a book called Unlock Congress. You're a good government guy. Give me your plus or minus about a paper ballot.
I don't think that that's necessarily a bad idea, and a couple people have actually asked me about that in the last couple of weeks. What's to stop us from going to paper ballots and having a receipt, making it harder to hack? One of the tricky parts of this is that the Constitution has the states run the election. So even if we wanted to nationalize the election and even if you did it digitally and tried to protect it, you still have to have the states do it. And I just don't think the states can all keep up and also even to the extent that they could improve what's going on when it comes to election security, they're going to be doing it at all these different levels, and they need different resources from the federal government. That gets into a bigger argument. But I'm open-minded to paper ballots.
Chris Roebling joins us. He is a Republican political analyst for WGN Television. Once upon a time in your background, you were a member of the Board of Elections for the city of Chicago, not known for clean elections, although there were no questions when you were there. But you know election law. You know how elections are run. Is this a good idea to try?
It's a good idea to discuss, but I'll tell you what precedes it in importance, based especially on my experience at the Board of Election Commissioners here in the city of Chicago. Elections are administered with an adversarial underpinning. And what that means is you've got to have Democratic election judges or election poll workers, and Republican election poll workers. And the natural adversarial relationship between the statutory parties then imbues the kind of down at the precinct level, keeping an eye on each other. So, like, the four of us are a terrific panel. The five of us are a terrific panel. You know, here are two Democrats, two Republicans, and here's somebody we're not, you know, Bruce is a journalist and keeps his opinions to himself. That's how you get a clean election, whether you're using paper ballots or computers. And what happens in a place like Chicago is you get imbalanced local administrative panels, and that leads to problems.
Just a quick follow-up is that frequently in Chicago, the Republicans, who at least pose as Republicans on primary day, they're really not Republicans.
That's right.
I mean, they're phony. They're ringers, okay? We don't know whether that's the case around the country where there are other, where large urban areas would probably be similar.
Philadelphia, Los Angeles.
Rebecca Abraham, you're one of our Democrats. You're a Bernie Sanders Democrat.
Yes.
So that could be mean that you're a good government Democrat, maybe.
I would like to think so. I do actually don't oppose going back to paper ballots. I think that technology has gone so fast and Board of Elections across the country haven't kept up. I know there's a lot of loopholes with hacking, and that's what we think we saw in 2016. We had a panelist, a good friend of mine, who was on a couple episodes ago, a couple months ago, and he talked about how the server is not secure, how any hacker, it's not that difficult to get in and start changing numbers. It could happen. I don't think paper ballots is a bad idea.
Jennifer Nevins, you are our Trump Republican.
No, I'm all in favor of paper ballots. I am in favor of a couple things. I think paper ballots would be a great idea. I also think we need to look long and hard at this idea of early voting. It seems like every election cycle, the early voting window gets longer and longer, and I look at that like a bigger time period for something to be exploited. I've served as a procedural judge on several election nights, and I know what chaos there is when you're counting those votes, and I think it would be greatly helped. It is important to have a balance of Republicans and Democrats. And I've seen it done in Aurora at the Election Commission very well, but I have to wonder how well it's done in other places, because it's highly manipulative. I mean, it's easy to manipulate that process. But I think paper ballots would be a great idea.
But in many voting machines, there is a paper trail, is there not?
Yes.
Yes. There is.
But so not all, but not all in the same way. By the way, I hope you don't want to cut down on early voting. I hope you don't want to close the window from where it is right now, because
why is it getting bigger and bigger every election cycle?
Well, I think what's good about early voting is it allows for people to vote, because already we don't have an election day as a holiday statewide or national, and it gives the opportunity for working people to vote.
Well, I would say that we don't need a 6-week window for somebody to vote. If you want to exercise your right to vote, I'm all in favor of it. In fact, I'd like to see the same fervor behind collecting the veteran vote and the overseas military vote.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
That we see with early voting.
It seems to me that every election, there's some chaos somewhere, whether it's the national election or even the state elections. And it seems to me like as a country, we can't really get it together. And one of the things that I want to...
Because the states run the elections. The country can't tell the elections exactly how to run their elections.
Hold on, Michael.
You know that, Chris.
The Constitution allows the federal government to dictate the terms for federal elections. And that's how NVRA, Motor Voter, came into play and had traction.
Allows gerrymandering the states. You can still rig.
I'm not saying that anything created by human beings is perfect, but there is a province of jurisdiction for the federal government in election administration.
When we come back, I want to get your reaction, 1-800-723-8029, to the idea of returning to paper ballots and also the integrity of the voting process in 2018. Based on what you know or what you believe happened in 2016, what are the other things that need to be done at the federal level and at the state level to improve the integrity of the balloting?
This March, Goodman Theater artistic director Robert Falls presents a thrilling new production of Ibsen's timely classic, An Enemy of the People. When a water contamination crisis puts their town in peril, two brothers face off in a battle of political ambitions and moral integrity. The fate of the community hangs in the balance. The Village Voice raves, An Enemy of the People is exhilarating to experience. An Enemy of the People at Goodman Theater, March 10th through April 15th. Tickets at goodmantheater.org.
Still back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. We're going to spend a couple more minutes on this subject, then we'll move on to some other issues. But what are the are you concerned, based on what you know, with you, Jennifer, are you worried about the integrity of the ballot this year?
No, I'm not.
Are you, Rebecca?
Always. I mean, you always have to keep your eyes and ears open.
Michael?
Absolutely. With what we know from the last
Chris
election.
Better to be safe than sorry.
That's a yes. Chris.
Better to be safe than sorry. And I do want to say, even if we go to paper ballot, there's something else that we've got to do,
registration.
I believe.
Registration.
Related to registration, and that's facial recognition. We have to get everybody's face captured. The government of the United Arab Emirates knows more about my face and my irises. So does the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So does Qatar. So does Bahrain. All these places I go for work, they all know me, and they can identify me like that, 100% certainty. I go to my own polling place, and if there's a new group of judges, they might have no idea.
Can I ask you a question about that? Let's say that you had your druthers and they were going to do that. How do you get 50 states to independently do that without a federal mandate? How do all 50 states do what you're talking about?
Well, the cost, I mean, they do it for free on Facebook.
I mean,
so
how
the cost
do you get
is like
all the states to agree with you? You can't, it's not like a federal law.
Here's how you do it. It's just like NVRA, Motor Voter. Here's what you do. That's the National Voter Registration Act back in 1991. Mm-hmm. And it's very simple. All elections for federal office shall be conducted with 100% certainty of the identity of the voter through appropriate technology.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In other words, if we know who is voting, then not only are we sure that everybody gets a chance to vote, but equally important, we're also able to say to every voter, your vote is not being diluted by somebody who is here illegally and who is voting.
That would be interesting. No. That would be interesting to see if the Democrats will go along with that, because they won't go along with the voter ID thing. But this seems like, wouldn't it seem like a reasonable thing? But you'd be surprised about the opposition.
You're describing a different form of voter ID is what you're describing.
But the whole idea about voter ID, the false narrative of the Democrats who are desperate for the votes of felons, for the votes of illegal immigrants, but the false narrative of the Democrats on voter ID has been it's impossible for a voter, you know, certain voters to get this or that card.
Right.
It's not impossible for those people to get cards. But in any case, everybody has a face. And so facial recognition is easily distributed to everybody, and just make it applicable to all elections for federal office.
And they probably will object to that based on privacy grounds. I can imagine them doing that, which is...
Give them ideas.
I mean, that's what they'll
isn't
do.
Isn't that a concern?
Use those grounds at times, Jennifer,
you guys will use it on
you're
this
You're mentioning
one.
Nations that are typically... I mean, like, I'm not... We don't know Saudi Arabia as this great democracy.
It happens in UK. It happens in London now. Now when I go to London, people are... They're beginning to gather. And indeed, our own, what ICE is, the people who do the borders and the people who talk to you at the airport, they're now beginning. We're about 3 or 4 years behind the more, like,
you're using it for security, for national security.
Speaking of ICE, I'm going to switch our gears now. Speaking of ICE, let's talk about what ICE has been doing in Northern California, primarily in Oakland, and the warning to illegal immigrants in her community from the mayor of Oakland. Is she doing good work, Michael Golden, or should she be strung up?
I'm not going to take either of those options. I am going to take issue, and not even in a partisan fashion, but with the Congress's brutally lame performance on passing extending DACA, doing something individually without holding it hostage for this comprehensive immigration bill.
No, wait a minute. You've gone to your talking point. My question is, I want you to answer.
You're going to my passion, unlocking Congress.
I want you to answer the question as a law-abiding citizen yourself. You have a situation where an elected official in Oakland is giving advance warning to those who are in the country illegally about actions of the government. Is she right or is she wrong?
I honestly don't know. I don't know enough about that issue. You're talking about sanctuary cities in California to weigh in intelligently, so I can't answer the question.
You can't weigh in intelligently
I'm not running for office.
The mayor of Oakland is giving advance notification.
She's a stoolie.
She's a stoolie.
Well, I mean, she's tipping. She's what do they call the runners? The runners or the guys outside?
She's a lookout.
She's a lookout.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, behold the intellectual dishonesty. I'm sorry, on the other side of the aisle, Michael. I got to tell you. You know, of the 150 people that were rounded up, it was like 95% were criminals, and a percentage of those actually committed crimes against children. Some of them assaulted children. And we're having a debate about this. This wasn't families being broken up that were law-abiding people. These were criminals that ICE was going to come and get, something that the Democrats say they're all in favor of. But then this mayor goes and gives the alert, hey, everybody, be careful, watch out. And that's supposed to be okay, and you can't comment on that?
I think what you're saying
is a false narrative. I read a study that most DACA recipients are overwhelmingly law-abiding.
I'm talking about the 150 that were rounded up, Rebecca.
I don't know enough about that particular story.
Do you not know about the mayor of Oakland and what she's been doing?
So much news every day. Oh, this is the one story I didn't. I think I heard it in passing, but not
Rebecca,
enough to comment.
I'm going
to
tell you guys.
I want to tell you guys, the national immigration law in this country is a joke. And Congress for years has not been able to pass something that would solve some of these local problems.
Michael, you'll have an opportunity to make that point when we get to the discussion. I'm asking you a simple question. You're a very bright, intelligent guy. I asked you if you think that the mayor of Oakland, California, is she doing the right thing and the wrong thing by giving advance notification to people in this country illegally that the feds are coming for her? Now, that should be a simple answer. Not a lot of BS that you've given us for the last 5 minutes.
I don't think it's BS to have immigration laws passed by Congress at all.
Well, that's not the subject we're talking about.
Well, my answer is, of course it's wrong for her to do so. Of course we're one nation under law, and we've got laws that go from Maine to Hawaii and Florida to Nome, Alaska. And these laws, they're either law, you know, positive law that's got to be administered by the executive branch and enforced, or Congress has to take it out of the U.S. code. If it's in the U.S. code, it's supposed to obtain all over the country, not with cutouts for Democratic vote-gathering purposes.
Why are there local law enforcement officers in cities like San Francisco and Chicago and other cities that are for that policy,
that would side
with the mayor?
A lot of conservatives,
you're law and order folks.
If I may say, many of them are elected just like this.
Yes. Many of them are not. Many of them are officers.
But that's still not addressing the point, Michael.
Let them finish.
Many are elected like Sheriff Israel down in Broward
County. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about rank and file law enforcement officers.
And I
want to
say those rank and file
keeps those cities safer. What Bruce is questioning.
Those rank and file work for elected officials. And I will say this: there is a vast difference between local elected officials making allocative decisions that they're totally empowered to make, and we all know the federal government cannot force the local government into administering federal law. We know that. We understand that under the constitutional scheme. So local people get to make allocative decisions about where their emphasis is. But what we had in Oakland was a local elected official actually impairing the administration of justice at the federal level.
Right.
And that is where you start getting to what resulted in Fort Sumter in 1861.
Wow.
Seriously. Because that was an issue. The Civil War began as an issue of the states in the South saying certain laws don't apply here. And what we have seen from the Democrats time and time again is we cannot adhere to certain laws and we're just going to nullify them.
Right. And the mayor also said that Oakland has the right to be a sanctuary city. Cities don't have rights. People have rights. This woman is such an ideologue that she comes up with this rationale for something that she did that was just flat out wrong.
Well, should she be punished?
Yes.
What should happen?
Well, if she might be susceptible to prosecution for obstruction of justice. And if she is, she should be.
Judge Napolitano the other day on Fox said that doesn't happen.
Then the city gets its funding cut off and it bleeds a slow death. I don't know.
I think if she warned people, I doubt they were criminals. Right now in Chicago, we have a mother and an 8-year-old child separated by ICE. So there's a lot of moral issues. I mean,
No. There is no doubt they were criminals.
I would put my nose out on a moral issue to stop families from being broken up.
I don't think it's as black and white as you guys paint the issue to be.
Sometimes laws are not on the right side of morality.
Lack thereof.
We have a.
Say that again.
Sometimes laws are not always on the side of morality.
Morality. These were 150, most of whom criminals that were rounded up.
How do you know they were criminals?
They were criminals by the government's own stats. They were criminals, some of whom had just been released from jail right before that announcement was made by the mayor.
I think Rebecca, the point is, were they illegal? Were they here legally or illegally?
Do we have comprehensive immigration reform where there is a place for people to come here legally, or once they're here to file for citizenship?
Let me ask the question that I asked, not the one that Michael wants to ask.
Okay.
My question is,
because I'm a reformer.
People,
I'm not a Democrat, as you keep
these,
describing.
These people, well, I don't think anybody would buy that. But my question to you is this. Do you believe that those people who are in the country, are they there legally or illegally? Let's find out whether they've even done anything
wrong. Even that answer is very complicated because we have children who parents are sending with backpacks and food trying to escape.
What about the parents? Here's my point.
Democrats
have a very difficult time defining a criminal.
The United States is supposed to be the safe place.
You have a very difficult time defining a criminal. You really don't know the difference between right and wrong, what's legal and not.
I think there are some laws that intentionally target black and brown people in this country.
You cannot define someone that's violated the law of the United States. You're oblivious
to it.
That's why folks lose elections.
Did a person murder somebody? Yes, that's definitely wrong.
Had you harmed somebody?
Yes. Did you beat somebody? Wrong.
All right.
Were you found with an ounce of pot?
That's good. You're getting.
I don't care about that.
You're giving me an answer.
Yeah.
You're giving me an answer. But the point is, they're in the country illegally, and then once they're here illegally, they've done something further illegal. Back shortly from Chicago. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at briansellsthedesert.com. Let's come on back in Chicago. We're going to switch gears, and we're going to also take telephone calls at 1-800-723-8029. But one of the big issues last week, which I know everybody wants to talk about, is the president's sessions, the listening sessions that he had at the White House. Then he brought the governors in. Then he brought the senators in. And during some of the discussion with the senators, both Republicans and Democrats, he shocked a lot of Republicans when he basically challenged them and said, hey, I think you guys are afraid of the NRA. That ticked off a lot of Republicans. And then he also went very farther than most Democrats could suggest when he talked about guns and background checks. In fact, the president at one point said, and there's the quote, people were shocked by it. He said, take the guns first and then go through due process second. Now, when you heard that, Michael Golden, what did you say about this man that you do not like?
Yeah. You know what? Actually, I think that President Trump has had a huge opportunity because of how he won to do some big things that presidents want to do in the middle. And he's not beholden as much as other presidents have been to the larger electorate. So forget what I think about his personal behavior. Sometimes when I hear him say, look, I think that was a ridiculous idea. You can't do that before you have due process. And I'm not someone who's, a huge proponent of the Second Amendment, but I believe in it. I don't think it should be overturned. And I knew as soon as he said that, he was just sort of spitballing, and within 24 hours he would change his mind. It breaks my heart that he doesn't at least stick with some of the things that people in the middle can support. He ran on an infrastructure bill. We're 14 months away. Our country's falling apart. The Corps of Civil Engineers says it's going to take $6 trillion to fix our country, and he hasn't taken the first little step to do it, and he could. His base will go nowhere. They are with him. He was right 3 years ago.
Jennifer, you are in that base, so let me ask you the question.
Right.
Some of the things that he said earlier in the week, when he talked about raising the age in which you can own a weapon,
right.
He talked about background checks, national background checks. He talked about all forms of bump stocks.
Mm-hmm.
including this little statement that he said, let's go in and get the guns.
Right.
Let's take the guns away from the crazy people, and then we'll worry about it later. Well, how did you react when you heard that?
Well, on the first thing that you mentioned, well, the last thing that you mentioned about take the guns first and then due process later, it was in the context of people with who were reported to have mental illness. Someone's having a breakdown. I'm afraid that my son's going to go down and shoot a school. Grab the gun, and then we're going to investigate. I think when he said due process, and this is the case with Trump sometimes, and this can be frustrating, that when he speaks, sometimes it's not as clear as it should be. And I think his interpretation of due process was, we're going to sort it all out after we remove the danger. So when I understand that about him. So I wasn't upset at that statement, because a big leitmotif of this whole argument is mental illness. If someone is truly mentally ill and a danger to other people, let's take that gun away, and then we'll sort out what's happening. The other things, like bump stocks, raising the age for people owning guns, I'm not a big fan of that. I think that it can be a slow creep. I think when you impinge on someone's Second Amendment rights, we have people in the military who are 18 years old, having guns. I don't know why we'd have to have a
is there anybody that you know in the Trump sphere, the people that vote, the real true Trumpsters?
Yeah.
Is there anyone that you've spoken with in the last couple of weeks that are worrying about this guy, that maybe because he doesn't have this ideological baggage that every president has had, as Michael had just said, maybe he can do some things that reaches across the aisle that go much further than anybody would have imagined?
Yes, there's always a contingent of people that I'm friends with that I know who've been uneasy from the get-go that Trump is not a doctrinaire conservative. That's always been there, that presence, that element of the Trump base, and I would count myself among them at certain points. But I think most of us look at the big picture. We really have to keep to the big picture, because there's going to be things we knew from the beginning, that there were going to be things that Trump did that confounded us, that frustrated us, that we didn't know how to deal with. But we had to keep to the big picture here, because there was a greater good being served. That's what most Trump supporters believe.
Chris Roebling, where do you come down on this particular issue? Is Donald Trump to the gun debate what Richard Nixon was to opening up China?
Well, I think that he could be. I think that he could discuss things and he could support things that, as Jennifer said, are outside the bounds for doctrinaire or doctrinal conservatives. I'm not saying that that's necessarily a good idea, and I'm not saying it's necessarily a good idea to emote or to react to emotions after a horrible tragedy like what we saw. And I think that the fundamental nature of the tragedy that we saw was one of government failing at, almost every level.
Yes.
And then those multiple failures sort of compound, each compounding the last.
Immigration, too.
Well, let's leave on this particular issue. You see government failing all over the place, and then AstroTurf imposition of left-wing Soros-funded organizations on those kids down there in Broward County, so that they become horribly, horribly props for the ultra left wing.
How could you call those kids props?
Well, they thought they were going to die. They're activists.
There was a young man that was on Hannity's program. He wasn't coerced to be on there. He was a teenager. He said, I was going to participate in a town hall. I came. I believe in the Second Amendment, but he said I wanted to participate in this forum, and they invited me. CNN invited him. He said that the story is
apocryphal. They went back on it.
So the boy's a liar. I thought all these kids were
No, they went back on it. Fox corrected that. That's not true.
Back it up.
They went back and corrected it.
That's what I'm saying.
That is correct. That young man did not tell the truth on that show.
He completely lied about it.
And Fox backed it up.
Yep.
Fox recanted that story the following day.
And there's another, and
these
there's a mother.
These kids are so brave. I can't understand how you
And there is
call
another. If this kid lied, which is a really rotten thing to do, but if this kid lied, then I'd like to know about, there's two other stories out there in print with mothers and the children saying the same thing, that they had questions that were manipulated and twisted around to participate
in these forums. The bigger, broader issue is the kids that were there, the ones that survived, they are also victims of what happened with
absolutely.
Their friends, okay?
No question.
So
horrible trauma.
I'm not questioning that a lot of them, most of them, maybe even all of them, really feel strongly about what they're saying. However, there are some elements in that group that are theatrical. Nothing wrong with that. There are those that have political backgrounds possible. There are parents.
They're people. They're human beings.
Right. But then, let's not. By the way, I'm not saying anything against these kids. These kids are moving. They're moving this discussion. I think they have moved the president of the United States. I don't know what you thought about the listening sessions. For the most part, until the president went off on, arming teachers,
saying things he didn't understand.
He was listening. He was listening to those kids, and I think he was moved by it.
He was.
No question.
I believe that, too.
And when you talk
about a movement, that it has natural drama, it has massive media exposure, the next question that I would ask when that valuable piece of American enthusiasm and grassroots anger is real, and it is real, should be real. But when that gets commandeered by outside forces, then it allows those who are NRA types to say, wait a minute, who's mixing this? You know, when George Clooney gave them $500,000 for their march, mm-hmm. I wish the kids would have said, we don't want your $500,000. We want this thing to be pure. Because now he came in with $500,000 and then Oprah came in. I mean, this march
still
on
the 23rd. Politics.
That's organizing.
Right.
They're
but
very
politics.
Effective organizers. Why are we gossiping about
but,
that?
But for being good at what they're doing.
No, here's my question. Do you understand that once that happens, it becomes a little suspect by some other people?
It's no longer authentic.
In a world where super PACs rule and the NRA gives millions, we're really going
Why do they need $500,000 for a national march?
Look, this shooter, let me tell you something.
To continue
this
funding
shooter picked the wrong. Finally, one of these shootings. I'm not saying that these laws are going to get passed because it goes back to Congress. No matter what the president does, it still goes back to Congress.
Yes.
But they picked the this killer picked the wrong demographic because these kids are going to keep speaking about this. I don't think it's going to go away. And I think there's going to be pressure on some of those moderates in Congress. I think you're going to see this issue.
We
were talking earlier about women, record numbers running in the midterm.
You already have it in Florida.
In Texas.
Rick Scott. Is Rick Scott a profile in courage based on what he's done? Right in the last 24 hours.
More than most Republicans.
I think so too.
But that doesn't have anything to do with the fact that we're talking about the media manipulating or using young people. If you Google right now, if you do on a YouTube, CNN transporting students to the town hall, it's a CNN bus. They've got all the kids loaded up in it. There's reporters on the bus with the kids yakking it up. They're having a big discussion. I mean, the whole thing reeks. The children, I'm sure that they feel passionately about what they went through. And
then
yes,
they're not
they are
props.
Victims.
Then they're not
they're
props.
Can't be used. A 16-year-old can't be used as a prop?
They're not props.
They can think for themselves, even if there's someone's trying to use them as props.
A teenager isn't easily manipulated.
They are experts now in gun control.
They are not experts.
You ever been involved in a shooting?
They have a different experience than I do. I've never experienced. I've never survived a shooting like that.
One at a time, Rebecca.
A nurse at a hospital after a shooting. It's terrible to see that.
Of course it is.
It was traumatizing for me, and I was never a victim.
They have been through unspeakable trauma.
An emergency room worker.
Right. They've been through unspeakable trauma. There's no question about it. They're an expert on what happened to them. There's no question about it.
And they're mad that it might happen again and again and again until we
have
common sense gun legislation.
They've got a long list of emotions, and every one of them is valid. And nobody is questioning any of that. No one is questioning their personal involvement in this issue.
And by the way, their immediate impact is in their state capital, and there's already indication that they got the attention of the governor. Right. Even though they were chanting and criticizing the governor for not taking the time to sit down and talk with them, he was busy creating the legislation that is now before Tallahassee.
He could have done both.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays, and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv.
There should be
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Michael was just saying, go ahead. Say it on the air.
Well, what do you want me to say?
What you were just about to say.
Well, we were talking about gun legislation, and I think that even though a lot of these very modest gun safety measures that may or may not pass, if history is any indication, they may not, even with what's going on with the Parkland teenagers we were talking about. But even if you did pass a couple of those common sense things, that's not going to all of a sudden solve the problem of gun violence in this country.
Right.
It's a far more
right.
complicated issue, even
right.
though I'm for those measures. But the bigger issue is, and Bruce knows I feel this way, no matter what President Trump does, he can give some members of Congress and his own party some cover. And that's why they said, well, you, Mr. President, you have to lead in that live press conference, but you still need the moderates to come aboard themselves. You're still, and by the way, then you need the Hastert rule to be eliminated. You need to have it up for a vote in the House.
Ryan's not following the Hastert rule, is he? Do we know? Do the listeners know what the Hastert rule is?
Well, I would love to explain.
The Hastert rule was the evil, the fundamentally evil one-time Speaker of the House, Denny Hastert, who was a child abuser, had been
criminal
for years and years, and is now blessedly in prison, and I hope he'll stay there for a long, long time. But anyway, Denny Hastert had a rule that he wouldn't bring anything to the floor that didn't have a majority of support in the Republican
right.
caucus. So he was a Republican. The Republican caucus was the majority in the House. And if there was one vote more than half in favor of a proposal,
right.
he would take it to the House.
So basically
he would not bring anything without.
So basically you could have a majority of the United States House that would pass a number of things representing the country. We elect members of Congress, but you can't even get it to a vote because
right.
of the Hastert rule, which, by the way, is not a formal rule. It's a custom. It's merely
right,
a custom,
right.
and Boehner kept it going, and Ryan has kept it going.
I don't think Ryan is operating
not
with
on
the
everything,
rule.
But on most things. Let's see if a gun safety measure comes up that the majority would support.
In this particular case, if Florida votes on the bill that was recommended or the series of bills recommended by their governor, Governor Scott, and other states, some states also have already in the last couple of weeks, they've dealt with bump stocks or they've dealt with other aspects of the bigger, broader discussion. Is it good enough if it happens at the state level and doesn't happen at the federal level? Or does it absolutely have to happen at the federal level, too?
I think it has to happen at the federal level. I mean, I think some legislation at the state level will help. But for an example, like a state like Illinois, the Illinois General Assembly is doing an excellent job of passing some legislation right now. However, most of Illinois' gun problems come from Wisconsin and Indiana. So if somebody wants a gun badly enough, they just drive an hour.
I don't think that has ever been proven. If it has been proven, I've never seen it.
The University of Chicago did a study, and most of the gun violence on the South Side stems from gun dealers in Indiana.
Like I say, I don't think it's ever been proven. I think that's an indication. I want to tell you this. There are so many guns in the state of Illinois anyway that right now, and there are so many.
And in the United States.
So, right.
Period.
Right. I'm just saying, in the state of Illinois, there were corrupt dealers. And there are a lot of guns, so people have formal and informal ways of – and straw purchasers. We just had a straw purchaser arrested out in Aurora, I think. A lady in Aurora was out there buying guns for gang members. I think she had just recently bought 5 guns in one day or something like this. Be all that as it may. There are three – if I may say quickly, there are three elements to this tragedy down in Broward County. Number one, our society. Number two – gun regulation. Number three, governmental integration. And the layers of government failed to talk to each other, and that created an enormous problem. And then that, if had they spoken to each other, had they identified this individual, maybe the gun regulations would have worked to prevent him from getting that gun on that day, which he used in that crime. And the third part, let us not forget, we can go pass a law that says, you know, the sun rises in the west. It doesn't change the reality that our society has awful video games that are teaching little boys how to kill people for points. You've got families without dads.
In other countries, you know.
I know. And we are seeing the effect of, in my opinion, societal disintegration over the last 30 to 40
element
years.
One other point I would add to your point, when you talked about government ineptitude, mm-hmm. and that is, you didn't use the term mental health, part of the background
Amen.
Checks
Amen.
Is the whole bigger, broader issue of mental health.
It's right. more, it's which more the president than three or four things. That's the thing. There's not, there's not one answer to this whole problem.
Why is it? If there's not one answer to the problem, then why is the one answer that the media and the Democrats want to push above all else is restricting gun ownership?
I'll give you the answer. It's dramatic, number
Absolutely.
One. And you know what? It's the easiest.
Mm-hmm.
It's the easiest in some ways, even though it may not solve the problem.
It also panders.
Get the guns.
It also,
the gun is the problem. Let's get the gun away. When you get to that next level of who should own the gun, then you get into mental health.
Then I have a question.
Wait.
It's slippery, a very, very slippery slope, too, because when you talk about mental health, is it someone who has gone through a bout of depression? Is it someone who takes Prozac? Is it someone whose therapist turned him in for seeing him for too many sessions? What is mental health?
Yeah, it's way too broad a label.
But here's my question. The Republicans keep blaming, you know, this is a mental health issue. This is a mental health issue. Where is the great Republican legislation on mental health care for all citizens then? Mental health care in the United States is terribly
where
underfunded.
Where has it been
since
for Congress, not just the Republicans? This country
the Republicans have a majority in all houses. Now is the time.
Wait a minute. But for decades, the Democrats did.
That's right.
This
sure.
country does not take mental health
right.
intervention and treatment seriously.
Right, because there's no
period.
Money in it.
It's a bipartisan black mark on our country.
Yeah.
And I want to say, I believe that the reason the Democrats and the media, which I repeat myself, go to this is because of soccer moms. Soccer moms in the November election. It is a very strong argument for soccer moms. Suburban moms are a top priority for Democrats. And that is a big
I want to counter this
issue.
Because I am a suburban mom. So I
think we have two on this program.
Yeah.
We do have to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Thanks for joining us. Another full hour coming up for those listening coast to coast on radio and the internet.
This March, Goodman Theatre artistic director Robert Falls presents a thrilling new production of Ibsen's timely classic, An Enemy of the People. When a water contamination crisis puts their town in peril, two brothers face off in a battle of political ambitions and moral integrity. The fate of the community hangs in the balance. The Village Voice raves, An Enemy of the People is exhilarating to experience. An Enemy of the People at Goodman Theatre, March 10th through April 15th. Tickets at goodmantheatre.org.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. We're Dumont back in Chicago. We continue, and it was a bad week for Jared Kushner. He lost his security clearance, and then he got lots of bad publicity on the New York Times, questioning things that he has done as a representative of the country, and also apparently helping his business as well. So let me ask everybody around the table, start with you, Chris. Is Jared Kushner going to be in this position a month from now?
It's I don't know about a month, but I would say the next place he'll find his desk is near the door. I mean, when you are that close to the president and the chief of staff takes you from top secret to secret, there is an issue. There is an issue, and if you read today's New York Times, we don't know, but it appears as though there are going to be ethical issues as well as, I think, some very serious judgment issues.
Explain for those that didn't read the Times, explain the intricacy of this case. It involves his father. It involves
right.
a loan.
Well,
the
Kushner real estate empire is not in robust financial health and wasn't at the time that Donald Trump decided to run for office. And so what has emerged this week is the apparent coincidence or post hoc ergo propter hoc relationship between meetings between Kushner and representatives of very significant outside interests at the White House, meetings at the White House with these individuals who, after the meetings, then channeled funds in the direction of the Kushner real estate empire, either as debt or equity or convertible, debt to equity.
But the loans were to his father, right?
Right, with the empire, the real estate empire.
Company.
And thus easing the financial burdens faced by the business enterprise. If that ends up to be the case, and these days out of Washington, who knows, given fake news, given the Democratic obsession through its large super PAC known as the national media to attack Trump no matter what, who knows what's true, but if it ends up being true, it's very bad.
Michael, is he on his way out quickly?
I think he is. It's a matter of when, and I think he was set up to fail from the beginning, not only because of these bad decisions he made ethically, it would seem, if all this is true, but also because the president saddled him with like seven jobs that were way – I mean, you have to be Superman to even make an impact on two out of the seven. I think he was set up to fail from the beginning.
Jennifer, what about it? Did the president make a mistake by bringing his son-in-law too close?
I would say yes, but not. I'm not clear on the minutiae of this. I haven't followed this particular episode at all because when I hear Russia, my eyes at this point just glaze over. But I will say that from the very beginning, the presence of Ivanka and Jared in the White House has always annoyed me and irritated me. I find it to be wholly unnecessary. I don't know exactly what they bring to the table, and I would not be sorry if Jared was shown the door, although I do resent the spectacle and also the tying of Trump to this. If it indeed does not, it doesn't even sound like this involves Donald J. Trump. It involves his family from what I can gather. But no, I won't be crying over it if he leaves.
Rebecca, is he gone?
I think he's going to be gone, and I think he's going to be in jail soon. It doesn't look good for him taking this money from foreign countries. I agree he was set up to fail. I don't know why this inexperienced businessman was given seven tasks that are should be left for
international
should be left for experts in international policy and law. He had
too
no
much
place
just too.
And I think he most likely engaged in illegal activities.
You know, I'm going to throw something in here that I was questioning whether I should bring this up as you were talking, Rebecca, but I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway. This idea of taking money from foreign governments, what is so convenient that the Clintons had going for them is they had this little thing called the Clinton Foundation. And countries could donate to this foundation in the name of charity, just like Russia did, $500,000 for a speech, 30-minute speech he gave on the grounds of the Kremlin. Different things like this could go on. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, other countries could give hundreds of thousands and in some cases millions of dollars. Russia gave $2.34 million to the Clinton Foundation over a four-year period. And that's okay. It wasn't really thoroughly investigated because it was given to this foundation. And that was so convenient. So really what Jared ought to have done is created a charitable foundation and then these people could have given it to them and then this wouldn't even be a problem.
Many of the countries that gave large sums of money to the Clinton Foundation did so because they thought that Hillary Clinton was going to be Secretary of State.
Absolutely.
During when she was Secretary of State or when she was president.
Yes.
So let's do that. Because if you go to the board of the donor board at the Reagan Library, mm-hmm. which is the best presidential library, you will see all those same countries. They all contributed to the building of the Reagan Library.
Well, absolutely.
It's sort of what they do to outgoing presidents.
May I distinguish?
Yes, you may.
Here's my distinction on that. The Clinton Foundation got going, I don't know precisely when, but it was in operation and it was receiving funds when Hillary Clinton was a United States senator.
Oh, that was the big difference.
And so she would get on the plane and she would fly around the world and she would meet with people and berate them or do whatever it is that she does that engenders such, you know, loyalty with her followers. And then they would suddenly write big checks. And when you follow Uranium One, which I know you two don't want to hear about.
Right. No, I was actually, I remember Uranium I was a Bernie One. Sanders supporter in the primary. I voted for her in the general and I did what I had to do as a Democrat, but I am not.
Here's a closing question.
That all started when she was a senator, running for president.
I stand corrected.
No problem.
Closing Jared Kushner question. If Jared Kushner is willing to punish Qatar for not helping his father, is that the same type of person that maybe would be willing to collude with Russia for the good of a business deal?
Maybe
as a I want to say looking that, at a character flaw, significant character flaw here.
If this element of aligning Kushner apparently has been an in-house supporter of the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Egypt blockade of Qatar. Okay, that apparently is the case. It might be because the Qatari Development Fund, the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Qatar, did not invest in the Kushner real estate empire. So if he did that because they didn't invest, he doesn't belong anywhere near the White House, you know, managing the paperclip supply.
We don't know that as a fact, but
I said
it's looking like that right now.
It's troubling. And the whole Qatar blockade is a thorn in the side of the United States and Israel and, frankly, everybody who is concerned about Iran, in my humble opinion.
All of this involving Kushner, does this also reinforce the power of John Kelly, who 2 weeks ago looked like he was on his way out? Isn't this another positive thing for General Kelly? Jennifer?
What is another like vindication Kushner, for John Kelly?
The defrocking of Kushner, the lessening of Kushner's
powers. Swan.
The powers.
Probably in that.
Is that a plus for him?
I think probably in that. I suspect that Jared and Ivanka, both of them, probably do a lot of pushing back on John Kelly. And if they were to be shown the door, I think it would definitely be a boon to John Kelly.
We don't know what kind of presidency we're going to have on the other side of this. Now, Democrats are going to say, well, we don't like the presidency we've got. I understand that they don't. They're never going to like anything. They're never going to forgive Trump for winning, beating Hillary or anything else.
No.
But the fact is,
it's not the winning, it's the lack of governing decisions.
Back Shirley from Chicago.
This March, Goodman Theatre Artistic Director Robert Falls presents a thrilling new production of Ibsen's timely classic, An Enemy of the People. When a water contamination crisis puts their town in peril, two brothers face off in a battle of political ambitions and moral integrity. The fate of the community hangs in the balance. The Village Voice raves, An Enemy of the People is exhilarating to experience. An Enemy of the People at Goodman Theatre, March 10th through April 15th. Tickets at goodmantheatre.org.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. One of the other big stories of last week caught everybody by surprise, at least initially, and that is Donald Trump's position on the trade wars and 25% tariff on steel coming to the country and also 10% for aluminum. A question to you, Jennifer. You're our Trumpster.
Yeah.
Was this a good idea?
Geez, you know what? I don't know if it's
a good idea. We know that the establishment Republicans and many Democrats
hate
this idea.
They hate this idea.
Now, does that mean that you as a Trumpster, you think it's a good idea?
No. That would put me in the cult of personality range, and that is not something that I subscribe to. And I've said that over and over again. Trump is fallible, and I've never said that he isn't, and I am willing to criticize him when he veers off tech. No, it's the absolute truth. Anybody who's watched
this
show any number of times.
Is this an issue?
I think it could be an issue. I would have to say that tariffs have been enacted by the European Union, and they are complaining about the tariffs that Trump wants to enact. So I think there's a little bit of hypocrisy there. I don't know, and I hear people like Larry Kudlow and people I respect say this could be a really dangerous thing for the economy. I sit up and I take notice and I say, what's going on here? I hope that he's treading carefully. One thing, I heard his guy Navarro on TV today, and one thing I can take away from it is this, is that if you were going to enact tariffs like Trump wants to do, it is important not to play favorites. So if you're going to enact a tariff, it should be across the board, because when you don't do that and you favor some countries over others, that's when you really could wind up in a diplomatic mess. So I would say that, I don't know, I have a wait-and-see attitude about it. I do know that he can rescind this if it turns out to be something that's going to be disastrous. So far, we're having some negative indications that this is not the best way to go, like from Electrolux and some other companies that are making noise about this right now. So I have a real wait-and-see attitude. I am cautious.
Rebecca, you are a Bernie Sanders Democrat.
Yes.
Some would say that this is further to the left than Bernie Sanders.
Well, but it's irresponsible because his tweet was irresponsible, and economic policymakers say this is irresponsible. While I want to bring jobs back to America.
Didn't they say the same thing about Bernie Sanders' suggestions?
No, because Bernie Sanders listened to economic advisors and didn't just say things off the cuff on Twitter. I want to bring jobs back to America, as the progressive left does.
Does the president.
But we've gone off the rails with global capitalism, and we live in a global trade world that we can't stop. There's globalization that we can't backtrack on. We can't backtrack in a day on 30 years of policy. It's going to take more than a tweet and pulling back and start putting tariffs on things. So what he did was irresponsible, and this will actually punish Canada the most, which is where we get most of our foreign steel from.
Chris Roebling, is this a big mistake by the part of the president?
I don't think that it is a big mistake, because it is not a very big step. It is a small step, but it is a very visible one. And that makes it seem bigger, I think, economically.
It's a big headline.
It's a very big headline, but economically, I don't think we're talking about a lot. We have to understand that tariffs operate as taxes.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And those taxes, the tariff, the use of the tariffed item ends up costing more. And that cost moves downstream towards the consumer. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's not good. What I think Trump is doing here is telling folks across the oceans, we are looking for reciprocity. And if you're going to be imposing tariffs on us of, 50%, mm-hmm. then you can expect similar treatment here. I think that's how you avoid trade wars, and that's how you avoid these trade dislocations. So that might end up being a good idea, but it's got to be very supple.
From a political standpoint, Michael, does this position help President Trump in Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Pennsylvania?
It might. It might. And I give Donald Trump credit for this. He said he was going to do this. He said it during the campaign. He ran a populist campaign. And even his messaging this week about why he's going to do this on tariffs was populist. When I read, like to Jennifer's point, when I read The Economist, who know a lot more about this, look, there's winners and losers in the economy when you make decisions like this, especially big ones. From what I read, and I'm not an economist, it looks like there's going to be more losers in the United States than winners in these industries. But you don't know. And the people who are fed up and elected Donald Trump, they wanted to see big strokes. I'm not saying that they're right or that this is a good idea. It doesn't look like a good idea to me. But politically, in some of those places, it may help them.
And
he is delivering on yet another promise.
Yeah, and look
no
at
one
the,
should
the,
be surprised.
Yeah,
that's what I said.
Right, and
None.
Look at the timing of it. It's 2018, and you have people like Joe Manchin coming out in West Virginia saying that he loves this idea. You have this going to be very popular.
And who's on the ballot in 6 months.
That's right. And you have this is very popular among the rank and file unions. And so I think that this very well might be a – may never really come to fruition, by the way, depending on how long –
Or it might in 2 days.
Yeah, or it might in 2 days, but there might be a political calculus here.
So no.
Just you can imagine that. Maybe, yeah.
Kind of, well, sort of.
But Donald Trump, everybody who runs for president learns a lot more about the country than they ever knew before they started running.
Absolutely.
And he has been into, you know, the hollows of West Virginia and the abandoned factory floors of Ohio.
Right.
And he has heard it time and time and time again. And if any of us believes that we are getting a straight or a fair deal out of global trade, especially on basic industry products like this, I think they're crazy. I worked for a congressman 35, 40 years ago who was a member of the Steel Caucus, and I remember the amount of work that was being done even then to try and save American steel. These are very big issues. We need to have a steel industry. We need to have an aluminum industry. And there are, I think everybody would say, what we've been doing, just like in so many other areas, what we've been doing for the last 25 years hasn't helped.
And people hasn't think it helped. The voters feel it has. Voters, that's how he got elected.
Michigan, Ohio,
something
Pennsylvania.
Different. Something different.
They say we were betrayed.
Yeah.
They say we were betrayed by some, you know, U.S. trade representative who never really understood
tell you
our
what,
needs.
A couple of his own people, though, have threatened to resign over this.
I
Gary Cohn and other people who
God
do have
God bless them. God bless them. Maybe they should.
They might.
You know,
I mean, I agree that global trade has done harm to American jobs and American workers, and there's a way to repair that, but I think it should be done responsibly. Donald Trump is not doing it responsibly. You just don't tweet something without talking to economic policy experts trade experts. You consult the experts.
This point's
and
up
he doesn't. That's his problem.
No, here's the point. Here's where you missed a lesson learned from 2016. Donald Trump doesn't talk to the experts. The experts have given us what we have now.
It's not that simple.
I don't think that's true.
535 members of Congress.
It may not be that simple, and I will acknowledge that. But when you talk about Donald Trump and you talk about the solutions that he has proposed during the campaign, many of them, the experts would all say, oh, my God, what a simpleton, what a simple idea. But you know what? That's that clear messaging, no matter how simple the message, that's what people voted for. And he kept he made a promise. He basically said, I don't care about the experts. He basically said that.
Sure.
He's governing now as I don't really care about the experts. I'm
that
not going to
doesn't mean he's right. It means that
of
politically
course
it, was,
it doesn't
he
mean
won.
He's right.
Yeah.
It means that he's won, and his goal now is to get reelected. And
right.
The people that voted for him once, he wants to vote for them a second time.
Yeah, I don't. But I
the resistance goes out and tries to find a candidate amongst not a impressive group at the moment.
You know what? I'll never make a prediction ever after having been so wrong in 2016 about Donald Trump. I won't make a.
Thank
you. I will not make a prediction about who's going to win. But I will tell you this.
I wish Matthew Dowd would
feel
the
same
way.
There are a lot of people I know in swing states who voted for Donald Trump, who I've talked to, who. They will say, I didn't think it would be this bad. I regret it, and I will be turning out in 2020. No question. Doesn't matter who's on the ballot. I won't for that doesn't mean he's going to lose, but I'm just saying that going to that third that's the base, I'm not sure for a reelection if that's going to do it in 2020.
I think one thing that he had to do or has to do, and because I think he can throw off, he can feel strong and say, listen, this is what I promised. This is what I tried. Even on immigration. I think he's got to get a wall built.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he can back away from the wall.
No.
That's the only thing that absolutely, positively, I think he has to
do. That's right.
I think he can do anything else with the base.
Almost.
Including giving, you know, going to the other side insofar as guns are concerned.
A wall built or funding for a wall?
No.
They're not the same thing.
He's got to get that wall started.
He's got started. That's not a wall built. Started and a wall built are totally different things.
But here's the point.
Correct. You know
he's got it. He's got to build the wall because that is the singular largest promise he made.
Right.
He can't get away with that.
No. Right.
If he does that and at the same time does something dramatic to the base and to many conservatives on gun issues, if he goes back to some of that touchy-feely that he had with the senators, not saying that you're going to take the guns away, but making his domestic issue gun control. Let me finish. If he does that, because this is what I was thinking about when I was watching that first listening session at the White House. I said, my God, you know what he's doing? He is finding an issue that could make him at least comfortable with suburban soccer moms.
Right.
He's come up with the issue. He's come up with the one issue, guns. and gun safety and even background checks and met all the one of the things that the Democrats would say some of the common sense things.
And he knows that.
And he knows that. And that's what I'm saying. And then, of course, you know, 10 seconds later, he's talking about arming teachers as, oh, well,
or he changes
he's
his
lost
mind.
The supper.
Right.
Or he's non-focused. He loses it. But I'm just saying is that's to me, that's the needle that he walks. He's got to do something very dramatic. And that will turn numbers in the suburbs of America.
About the moms of the United States, these are the gals that are coming out now to vote that have never voted before, and they're voting Democratic.
Yep. In the primaries, the turnout
yes.
is over
and
the moon.
And one of the
in
things
Texas,
I...
In
but
Texas.
Hillary couldn't inspire them, these women, to get out and vote?
No.
Clearly not.
Do you know why? As
you're going back. That's over. We're talking about
right.
2020.
And moving forward, one of my goals as an organizer and why I jumped into politics as a nurse with little experience is as a working-class woman with a working-class blue-collar job, I want to see other moms and women get out there and vote, and they never have before because they felt disenfranchised. They didn't have time. They felt like they can't bring their children with. And what I do is I try to make women comfortable bringing their children along to vote, to get organized, to knock on doors, and that's what's happening.
Okay, we're going to pause. Back shortly from Chicago. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. During the break, Jennifer, you said you wanted to make a comment. You disagree a couple of weeks ago. I think the idea of arming teachers is a very bad idea.
Yeah.
You disagree. Why?
Arming teachers... When you say generally, yes. Oh, let's pass out the guns and arm teachers. It's kind of how it's being framed right now that Trump is suggesting this. And he wasn't. He made it really clear that I'm talking about former military who are now teachers, people who have owned guns and are experts at using weapons, who volunteer to have a weapon in the school. He's talking about certain individuals being certified, paid extra for doing this. So it's not what the media is characterizing it as, and some Republicans are characterizing it as, oh, here's a bucket. We're going to pass out the guns. Everybody keep them in your desk drawer.
Yeah. And then golf and baseball
and that's
comparison.
Not, I
if
think,
you have a good touch for golf,
I think
you could be
he
good
made,
with a gun.
I think he made an excellent argument for the fact that when you put a sign on the door that says gun-free zone, and everybody knows that that school is a gun-free zone, you're just a sitting duck. I think he made a good argument.
That's what happened
at Sandy Hook. He said, if you're a good baseball player, if you're good at golf, you could be
good
with a gun.
You didn't listen to his conference when he explained all of this.
I'm quoting him.
All of this.
That's what he said.
I didn't hear it. He may have said that.
People have a talent.
Let me go to the real issue here is that when you look at multiple victim public shootings, almost invariably, these very troubled individuals who are desperately making some sort of horrific statement evaluate their target area. And we the two classic cases of that are in Colorado and in Connecticut. And in Colorado, the shooter could have gone to any one of a number of movie theaters. He went to the one movie theater in that group, in that area, that was a gun-free zone. And in Connecticut, for the shooter to get to Sandy Hook Elementary School, he passed by the high school, and Sandy Hook, the elementary school, was a gun-free zone. So this idea makes all the sense in the world that the folks who are inside the school, whether they're an administrator, certified staff, who knows what they are, but if they are fully qualified and competent with guns in their out-of-school life and they want to take an extra class, I mean, we're already granting, you know, step and lane changes in so many states for individuals who are inside the schools and taking a little extra training to get a lane change or sometimes a step change. This makes all the sense in the world.
Right. And these are teachers we're talking about, responsible, degreed professionals, not just some Yahoo off the street.
No, but also keep in mind that he, in the initial conversation, he talked about coaches. He talked about custodians. Mm-hmm. He talked about somebody. He almost threw teachers in. So his initial comment was not arming every teacher. You're correct on that. Again, that's the way that it sort of played out. But in all these listening sessions, he keeps coming back to that point. He also keeps coming back to another point, and that is the issue of mental health. You mm-hmm. sort of dismissed it that maybe it was too complex an issue because mm-hmm. it has so many different connections to it. I want to get everybody's reaction to that. Because the other thing he's talked about bringing back mental institutions. Mm-hmm. Does anybody think that's a good idea?
I do.
You know?
I do.
You're a nurse off the ward.
Right.
I'm a nurse. I do case management now. We have a lack of places where people can go to get inpatient treatment. I think the key is back in the 60s and 50s, yeah. I know that they were terrible places. I think with well-funded, paid professionals and a good environment, I think people would do really well. The people who need some inpatient care, I do think we need them. Right now, our mental health is treated as an inpatient, mostly in prisons, jails, and on the streets. It's awful. A broken clock is right twice a day.
but again, going back, I mean, whether or not, I mean, this would be a huge debate. And as I said, you know, in the last couple of segments, neither Republicans or Democrats have really focused on this issue since the movement of the late 50s, which was to close all the institutions.
Yeah, right.
And what happened with that is, and a lot of them were poorly run.
Right.
But what happens, that's why we have so many homeless people on the street, many of whom are mentally ill.
Right.
You go into any prison or jail in the United States, the majority of those that are there have a mental illness, and they're not being treated with any degree of success.
And with good inpatient and outpatient care, I think we could see a lot of successful people, people who can control their illness. And it's really sad. And I do think the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress should have done something 50 years ago.
Oh, clearly.
You know, we have the same problem with foster care. We have underfunded systems. But it's going to take money and revenue to boost these programs.
And do we have – because one of the complexities of this issue is the overprescribing of our population – because there's a lot of people out there that say that these drugs, if you don't take them for a day, then you become more susceptible to violent action. So there is a pharmaceutical aspect to this, and then there's the dollars and cents thing. Where are you going to put them?
Because
I would think the idea, I would assume we probably have a shortage of mentally health trained. Social workers in this country,
well,
and doctors that work on that.
We do have a good number of social workers and mental health workers. The issue is that they are severely underpaid. So it's not totally a shortage, but it's not work that people want to go into. Mental health nursing, it's a hard job for $30 an hour, which sounds like a good wage, but you get hurt by your patients. It's a very, very challenging job. Another thing you brought up was prescription drugs, and I think the capitalism in healthcare is part of that problem because we're throwing drugs at people that should be treated in other ways, with therapy, with, you know, there's other treatments, but they're not prescription drugs.
So is Medicaid. Medicaid is part of that problem. In other words, the ability of folks to receive almost limitless supplies I would say the lack of accountability, the lack of oversight and accountability in the Medicaid system, so that you've got individuals. I mean, you have these towns in West Virginia. God, your heart breaks to hear about it. But, you know, there are 400 people in the town and they're getting 83,000 pills per year.
That's pharmaceuticals again. That's not Medicaid. There is not a good drug funding under Medicaid. It's very challenging to get drugs actually.
By the way,
Medicaid
Donald Trump was going to appoint Steve Marino to be the drug czar, and he's one of the ones that was not forceful about laws preventing that from happening from the pharmaceutical companies. And he had to pull him at the last minute when it was reported that he wasn't strong on these laws in Congress. Could I go back to the gun thing for a second?
But he did pull him.
He did pull him. No, he pulled him. Pulled him from being nominated. To Jennifer's point, this is where I like wonder if there is a middle way on security in the schools. I'm not for arming the teachers, even though it's, I know you say general teachers. But however, I think that there was a woman who was the mother of one of the kids. She lost her child's life in that shooting, and she was the one who was yelling. And then they brought her on, and she yelled in the town hall. But one of the things she was yelling is, why aren't there security guards in the front of the school? Why aren't there metal detectors? And to me, it seems like I don't necessarily think there should be a gun-free zone, but couldn't there be one central precautions where you can't get into that school without passing an armed security guard who is licensed, who is certified, who has got the training? But I don't think that having teachers all over the school with guns is the answer. Isn't that a possible answer, and to secure the entrances of all public schools at a minimum?
It's a possibility, but the idea also, I think you can run into some trouble with having one way into a school. When you have a large school, you have to have other exits out of the school,
yeah,
so
fire,
you can have
right
fire hazards, things like this. So is there a way?
But isn't there a step there, immediate middle step to getting more
security?
There
very well could be, but okay, we're not hearing from it because we're hearing a lot of things about how they need to be gun-free zones.
Folks, let's take a call. Crystal, listening to us in Yosemite, California, listening to us on Sirius. Go ahead, you're on the air, Crystal.
First of all, I just want to say that I'm aghast that the Florida legislature has voted on this. They voted on it yesterday. They had a special session on Saturday. I was a high school teacher, and I can assure you that there were plenty of people who fought alongside me who could absolutely not be given a gun and put in the classroom under any circumstance. They couldn't even handle having the ability to control dress code violations without overusing that power. So to arm a teacher is not the answer. The answer is to deal with the gun. We're not going to deal with the gun. And all this is a way to not spend the money to put an armed guard in front of every school. So instead, what they've decided to do in Florida is to give teachers $500 as a one-time stipend. And they can address the state's going to purchase the gun, whether the state's going to individually purchase the gun, whether the county's going to purchase the gun. I couldn't have Clorox cleanup wipes in my classroom. I couldn't have the code to the copy machine to copy more than 200 copies per 30 days. But they're going to trust a teacher with a gun? And I didn't go to school so that I could wield a gun and control if somebody comes in to shoot me. I went to school so that I could teach students about biology, so that I could empower them, inspire them in science, not so that I could defend their life. This is absurd. I didn't go to school to be a police officer, and I didn't sign up to go to war. And nobody's asked the teachers about this. What I see is
I don't think this should be something that you force at any teacher.
Yeah. Right.
There are some teachers that may want to do this. There are some states where you can do this now. This is not something that you'd want to make into a national effort. I think teachers should teach. I think there should be security guards in school, armed security guards in school, in a uniform, so you know who they are, and they should be responsible. And they could be ex-military.
And there should be teachers. There should be controlled access. There should be a secured perimeter. There should be a process for gaining entry. A magnetometer. I mean, there should be some of the rudimentary steps that we take for granted when you go to a, say, downtown office tower. Why not? Why are we doing it for there but not for the kids, okay?
And so, when we come back, we're going to pause. I'm going to come back and add one other thing, that in addition to all this school safety, let's talk about mental health and where do we put the mental health areas. Where do we put the storefronts that can deal with the issues for parents who have children? They know they're going to explode someday, and they've got no place to go. Back shortly. Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays, and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Order tickets at museum.tv.
When you went car shopping, you meant business. You aced vehicle history searches and test drives. You out-salesmaned the salesman. Now you've got your wheels. If you manage that, you can get your retirement plan on track. Visiting aceyourretirement.org can help. With 401k tips and smart savings strategies, you'll have the info you need to get more for your future. Go to aceyourretirement.org, because when it comes to speeding past financial challenges, you're an ace. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Oh, yeah, okay. Christian went back. Let's go to Tom, listening to us in Youngstown, Ohio, on WPIC. Go ahead. You're on the air, Tom.
Thank you, Bruce. You know, you guys talked about the guns in school, and the governor of Florida wants to spend $500 million with bulletproof glass and steel doors and metal detectors. But the problem with that is that the people that have these kind of anger issues are going to take it out someplace else, another soft target, like buses, playgrounds, concerts, restaurants, theaters. So we have to look at that. And I think as a society, we're better off looking at the mental health issue that you were talking about, Bruce. And it was actually happened so often that a phrase was developed from it, going postal. About 35, 40 years ago, there were people who came back, I think for the most part, from Vietnam, who were hired by the post office, couldn't adjust, and they actually came to work the workplace with weapons and started killing people, their fellow employees.
Right.
I think that was, I'm not sure, but I think that was resolved by better screening who was hired. And I think we have to better screen who's able to go to public schools. Take the people who are bullies and put them in reform schools. If you want to call it military academies, fine. And take the people who have severe mental issues where they, you know, could explode at any time, and get them the help that they need, but don't leave them in the same environment of the normal kids that just want an education.
Chris Roebling's got a comment.
Tom, I just want to mention to you, the Broward County School Board came up with a harebrained idea that they would not report to local law enforcement infractions by kids on their property. And so not only did Broward County law enforcement fail to follow up on more than 30 visits to the home, some for this individual and some for his half-brother, I understand, but there was no gathering of the understanding of the certified staff, the professional educators at the school. That information was not gathered and given to law enforcement. In fact, law enforcement is not allowed to execute any process on the property of Broward County Public Schools. Why? Because the school board doesn't want to have those statistics gathered,
right,
indicating that the school board isn't running the schools well. So I believe that Tom has put his finger on this issue of government coordination and integration for the benefit of the little kids, the classmates, the individual him or herself. It's always a him, but the individual himself, his family, the families, the parents, the entire community. So we've got so many sad, regrettable failures here in terms of the cops and the school board and the school administrators, in terms of the family situation of this kid that didn't really get him to the
FBI
kind of
too.
The FBI.
Yes, the
so, I mean, there's a lot of things that connected up to allow this to happen.
You can't say that there is some sort of cure-all that, you know, one legislative proposal in Tallahassee is going to take care of everything.
I agree there is no simple answer, and I do think there's a couple of factors. We have terrible mental health, we have easy access to guns, and we live in a mean, harsh society that's becoming lonelier and lonelier. So I think we need to collectively become just nicer people so people don't feel isolated. But then,
and we have social media makes bullying easy.
Yeah. And I do think bullying is a problem, but it's not going to be solved by one thing. But I do think that teachers should not have guns in school. I think it's a dangerous idea. There was an armed guard at the school, and he ran away, which was terrible.
Yet another failing.
That's part of the job. Yeah. But I we could keep the Second Amendment, but one thing I think we have to do is we have to have a comprehensive federal database, and we do have to have some restrictions. There used to be a 5-day waiting period. I believe that's gone now. We should have a waiting period. We should have registration. We have all the things you have to do to drive a car. If you have to take lessons, you have to have a permit. You have to have education, and you have to be screened that you could see that you don't have epilepsy. Why not have the same thing as a gun owner?
One last thing, because you frame this a lot of conservatives, Democrats, Antonin Scalia, in the Heller decision,
right,
he is a staunch Second Amendment advocate on the Supreme Court and one of the, I'd say, most highly revered conservatives in the history of the court. And in that decision, he said precautions can be taken.
Absolutely.
When it comes to gun ownership.
Absolutely.
When it comes to buying guns.
Absolutely.
And Congress needs to say that a lot
of the precautions that have been instituted actually came from the NRA. I just want to make that point. The NRA is not a, quote, terrorist organization. And people who go on to say that are just simply, I think, polarizing debate for political purposes. I'll say another thing about Nino Scalia. He went to Xavier High School on 22nd Street in New York, just off of Washington Square Park, a few blocks north. And when he went there, and for years and years after his going there, kids, it was a military school, Catholic military Jesuit high school in the city of New York, and big gun teams. And the gun teams in those days carried their guns to and from school in little cases on the New York subway, the Long Island Railroad.
Different world. It was a long time ago. It was a different world.
What makes it a different world is what we need to look at.
Really. I agree.
Well, we'll try to solve that one next week. We didn't solve the gun control issue. We didn't. What did we solve?
We've got Jared Kushner going.
Yeah,
he's on his way to Nome, Alaska.
Yeah, and Hope Hicks, she's gone too.
Texas turnout this week.
Any Texas turnout? A quick prediction. What is it?
I can tell you this: in Texas, in the 15 largest counties in Texas, the Democrats have outperformed by 115% versus 15%. Republicans have turned out more than they did in the midterms.
Are you predicting a big...
I'm predicting in the midterms a huge backlash to Trump and a wave. I'm not predicting that they'll take it back, but I'd be surprised if they didn't. Let's put it that way, if Democrats didn't take it back.
Okay, there you hear it. You've heard it here. Who did you pick? You predict Hillary Clinton in that one, right?
I did.
Back next week, I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
This March, Goodman Theatre artistic director Robert Falls presents a thrilling new production of Ibsen's timely classic, An Enemy of the People. When a water contamination crisis puts their town in peril, two brothers face off in a battle of political ambitions and moral integrity. The fate of the community hangs in the balance. The Village Voice raves, An Enemy of the People is exhilarating to experience. An Enemy of the People at Goodman Theatre, March 10th through April 15th. Tickets at goodmantheatre.org.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at briansellsthedesert.com.